White Rocket Entertainment.
I'm Brandon Marcello, and you're listening to the AU Wishbone.
They're not going to keep him off the field tonight!
White Rocket Entertainment, podcast number 403.
A miracle in Jordan Hare! A miracle in Jordan Hare!
You are listening to the AU Wishbone, almost credible sports discussion on the War Eagle Sports Radio Network.
Hello and welcome to the AU Wishbone, brought to you by White Rocket Entertainment in association with TheWarEagleReader.com and by all of our great friends and patrons via Patreon.com. I'm Van Allen Plexico, and I'm joined as always by my co-host.
I'm John Ringer.
And John, tonight, as we are every year at this time, it's become an AU Wishbone tradition, and I'm very excited about it. We are joined by Auburn Undercover's stellar reporter and analyst, Brandon Marcello, our own Brandon Marcello. Welcome back aboard, Brandon.
Hey, thanks for having me, guys. I always enjoy coming on here.
Yeah, it's like our rite of spring, right? We have A-Day, and we have the baseball season gets going, and the basketball season ends, and then we bring you on to kind of just catch up on everything and see what you think is important stories to be looking at and what we maybe don't know, and to kind of clarify some things we think we do know. So John and I have a few questions for you, and our listeners have some. But first, how are things going with you? I know you had a young'un come into the world a few months ago, and I know you're running around covering the various Auburn teams and all that, and you've had some a little changes, I think, happening where you do your reporting. So just kind of fill us in real quick on what's new on your end.
Yeah, our baby boy is almost a year old now. He's 10 plus months. He's almost 11 months. He's a terror, but also he's also the happiest baby ever. He's always smiling, and he's at the point now where, for example, right before we started recording this, he was not running around. He was crawling all over the living room and kept trying to come into my office and kept coming in here. And every time he peeked his head around the corner, he's smiling, trying to get my attention, which always that happens a lot now. And it really deviates me from my work. Anyway, I just put him down to sleep, or at least my job is to soothe him down, put some lotion on him, change his diaper, put him in his pajamas, and then hand him over to mama for feeding time and sleep. And so I just did that. We'll see if it worked. It probably didn't, like usually wakes up a few times. But anyway, outside that, professionally, still with 24/7 Sports, Auburn Undercover finally merged with the Scout.com site, as everybody remembers, as Inside the Auburn Tigers. It's co-branded now, so it's the longest name you'll ever hear. Auburn Undercover and Inside the Auburn Tigers. Jason Caldwell and Mark Murphy joined us. Most of the Scout sites merged with the 24/7 sites. 24/7 bought out Scout, I guess, almost 2 years ago. So it was like a long, long process. It finally happened here in March, right in the middle of Auburn basketball's run in the SEC tournament, and came at a good time. But that's going on. Still trying to figure out how I fit into everything with that. I won National Beat Writer of the Year from the Associated Press Sports Editors. And
that's amazing.
I'm very honored. I couldn't believe it. I'll be picking that award up at a ceremony in Atlanta. I don't know what to expect. I've never been a part of something like that. So that's crazy. Let's see what else. And then, of course, just sports wise, as far as the things I cover, I mean, it's never quiet, and it just seems like everything's just rolling. The one sport I don't really cover all that much, really I haven't covered in 2 years, is baseball. And man, they're heading to Omaha for the College World Series, and I have said it since day one, since Butch Thompson was hired. This guy is going to do things at Auburn that hadn't been done in a while. And he's the guy that I thought they should have hired before Sonny Galloway, a guy's name who should probably never be repeated again in Sonny Galloway. But Butch Thompson is just an incredible coach, and what he's done this year with so many injuries, especially to pitchers, and then losing Casey Mize, the number one overall draft pick last year, it's remarkable. The basketball run, that was one of the most fun things I'll ever cover, in addition to the 2013 football season. So it's been a heck of a year, guys. It's been a heck of a year.
It really has. I mean, I didn't even realize, I haven't really focused on the baseball team, because every time I would see anything in the media about them, it was basically saying, well, they're about to lose and be knocked out. And then I would see something on Twitter to the effect of, oh, they won. And I'm like, hey, they won? Well, then they'd say, well, that was it. It's been a nice run, but this is it. And then they'd win again. And so apparently today they had a big – was it yesterday they had a big when was the big blowout win over North Carolina? Was that today?
I can't. That was this afternoon.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, I saw some highlights of it, but I guess they already had highlights up on YouTube that fast. So what? Well, what's going on, before we get anything else, what's going on with the baseball team that's caused them to be able to suddenly do this? What's got them on this tear?
I'd be quite honest, I don't know. And I think that's the one thing that makes baseball so interesting, is that you just never know going into postseason play. I mean, I was looking at, someone posted a stat about how Auburn, I think, maybe was the only team in the, I guess you could call it the Sweet 16, but the Super Regional play, that did not have a batter in the starting lineup with a 300 average. They all bat below 300, and yet then they come out, you know, on Monday and score 13 runs in the first inning. I mean, before North Carolina can even come to the plate, they're down 13-0. It's insane. I think it's just great coaching. And in addition to great talent, I'm a guy who always says, listen, you know, players win games, coaches lose them. There's something special about this team as far as just the coaching that's going on. And Butch Thompson, I have not talked to him since he was hired here at Auburn, which is probably, you know, that's my fault, but also just a part of circumstance, because I don't cover baseball all that often. I usually just either whether I was, you know, what outlet I was at, they didn't want us to cover baseball, or where I'm at now, Jason Caldwell does such a great job with it. There's no sense in me stepping on his toes, but I haven't talked to Butch Thompson ever here, and I covered him when he was at Mississippi State. He was a pitching coach there. I was a beat reporter, and you know what? Mississippi State baseball is huge, so we covered that like football, man. And I sat in his office a couple times and just, you know, shot the hay with him, so to speak, and talked pitching and development of talent and what to do. And he was pretty much he was a co-architect of that Mississippi State program going back to the College World Series and then actually being the national runner-up in 2013. And after that happened and things were going badly here, I thought, that's the guy you got to go hire. He's a guy who's coached at Auburn before. He loved it here. You've got to go get him to be the head coach. And it took a few more years, a couple more years, but they finally got him here after the just bad misfire on Sonny Galloway. And look what he's done. They've literally gotten better each year. And now they're going to Omaha for the first time in 22 years. And like I said, I don't cover them often. Like you, I'm not too familiar with what's actually going on. But I've been watching them this postseason. And I think it's just the players are talented. But the coaching is kind of all, it all comes together at one point. And the great coaches find a way to get stuff done in the postseason, especially with the college baseball teams, particularly one in which Auburn struggled with their pitching because of injuries. And Butch has that pitching background as a coach, and that's, he finds a way to cobble things together. I saw him do it at Mississippi State with his pitching staff, and he's done it here at Auburn. And things are very bright for Auburn. It's good. It's going to be interesting to watch, not just this season as they go try to play for a national championship, but here in the next couple of years.
John, you had actually a couple of questions related to that about the success of basketball and baseball, if you want to tee those up.
Sure. The one thing about baseball is it definitely seems like it's partially a result of the SEC being really good at beating each other up. And then when they got out of conference and played other teams in the World Series and these regionals, it seems like the SEC teams really dominated. So the first question is from Samuel Salvatore, who says, hey, do you think that North Carolina wants to play Auburn in the postseason any sport ever again? and he also talked about the parallels with the basketball and the football program. I mean, the basketball and the baseball program, where both teams overcame injuries, as you said, the basketball team rained threes on them, and the baseball team hit them with three run doubles and homers. And both were really exciting big postseason runs, punctuated by wins over North Carolina, which is always great. So he said, "War Eagle, y'all."
Yeah, you know, North Carolina just doesn't want to see Auburn again, mm-hmm. I'm sure, in any sport. Problem is, they have to open the 2020 football season against Auburn.
I was going to say, so. I thought we'd go to the Georgia Dome, and the Benz, yeah.
Yeah, so they'll be facing off again. Maybe Auburn can get the Triple Crown. and not just that, but they've just been demolishing North Carolina. I mean, they beat North Carolina by 17 in the Sweet 16 in basketball. And then obviously they won 14-7 in game three of this super regional Monday. They're not just beating them. They're beating the crud out of them. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if a lot of people remember this, but like going into the Sweet 16 for basketball, I mean, North Carolina, the losses they had, they weren't blown out. I mean, every game was close with them that they lost. And Auburn just ran all over them in the second half. And what I'll remember most about that game, obviously, is Chuma Okeke getting injured. But right. Not just that, but the way Chuma Okeke was playing in that game. He was having his moment, his NBA moment. Mm-hmm. He was on his way to like having 30 points and 12 rebounds or 15 rebounds in that game. Until he got hurt with 8:08 remaining in the second half, and I think it was just a special game, and obviously what they did in the next game in the Elite Eight against Kentucky without Okeke was amazing, and for Auburn baseball, they've been fighting injuries like all season. So like the Auburn basketball team, their injury was pretty much just Austin Wiley, you know, midway through the SEC season, but he wasn't really contributing a lot offensively, and then Chuma Okeke going down in the Sweet 16, and Auburn still managing to find a way to get to the Final Four. But this baseball team, I'm obviously not downgrading anything the basketball team did, because I thought it was a season for the ages, and I know fans don't want to hear this, but they should be national champions right now, if not for that stupid whistle by the ref, or non-whistle by the ref, I should say, and then the whistle on the three-pointer. They should be national champions right now. I think they would have went on and won the national championship.
No question.
If they had Chuma Okeke, they definitely would have won. The refs wouldn't have mattered, because Auburn was on such a run and they were in such a flow. Like I said, I mean, they blew out North Carolina because of Chuma, and he was hitting his stride. I don't think anybody would have been. They would have maybe had a close game, but I don't think they would have been in a deficit against Virginia or anything like that. I think they would have been controlled the entire time. So anyway, having said that, I think the coaching job by Butch Thompson has to be maybe the coaching job of the year among all the Auburn coaches, because he's dealt with several injuries throughout the year, not just here and then there. And they've happened with the pitching staff. Andy had to replace the first number one draft pick in Auburn history, and he happened to be a pitcher in Casey Mize. It's really remarkable what he's done. Andy's had to do this. I know Auburn had to beat three blue bloods, you know, the three winningest college basketball programs. But baseball, they've had to go on the road to Georgia Tech and then to North Carolina. One team ranked as one of the top 16 teams, maybe both of them were. I just don't follow baseball that closely, but it's really remarkable what he's done, and just the offensive explosion by them is something else.
It's hard to imagine in a year where Auburn went to the Final Four in basketball, and like you say, arguably should have won the national championship, that we would be saying another coach was coach of the year. But yeah, it's legit. I mean, that's. It's insane, and it's not the football coach too, which is absolutely crazy. But But one of our questions was, do these different successes bleed over into each other? I mean, does it cause like the whole department, the whole athletic department to gain momentum? Does doing well, I mean, did the basketball success, is it going to help football, or is it helping baseball, or are they all totally on an island?
I think there is some legitimacy to that. How much, I don't know, but I'll say this, like, you know, Big Cat Weekend for football, for recruiting was, I guess, a week ago. And it was almost like a combined event for basketball and football. I think the weekend for the unofficial visitors ended that Saturday with Bruce Pearl and Gus Malzahn speaking to, I think, both groups or something like that. They're in the same building as they were all departing. So that was very interesting to me. And Bruce Pearl had, you know, really kind of embraced, you know, Gus Malzahn when he first came on board here at Auburn several years ago. And now, I mean, Gus Malzahn embraced him from that moment. They really like each other. I think Gus Malzahn is very much attracted to coaches who have a very opposite personality to his own. I'm serious. Like, he really loves people that are out there. I think it entertains him, and he wishes he could kind of be like that. And he surrounds himself in his life by people like that quite a bit. You'd be surprised. People who are really energetic and just kind of out there and are entertaining, but also winners. And Gus and Bruce Pearl are pretty good friends. And I think now what you're seeing is, Bruce has returned the favor. Gus is like trying to parlay the basketball success into some success for football when they're recruiting. I mean, there are football recruits that are wanting pictures with Bruce Pearl during these recruiting visits. It's quite remarkable. So, wow. Yeah, I think there's tangible evidence just by that. These players wanting to see them. And then as far as basketball recruiting, I mean, goodness, they're in on like a dozen five-star kids now. That wasn't happening a year or two ago. And it's because of, one, this Final Four run, but the SEC tournament title, the SEC championship they had a year ago. He's proven that he can win games and win championships at Auburn. And he's done it with, he had a five-star guy in Austin Wiley and Mustafa Heron. But Mustafa left, and Austin Wiley was injured most of the year, and he still won titles. Now imagine what he can do if Auburn has, say, 2 5-stars and a bunch of 4-stars on their team. That stars don't win you games or whatever, you know, those recruiting rankings, coaching helps and all that. But when Bruce Pearl gets elite talent, boy, watch out. And that's not a slight on what Auburn had this past season. They had some elite talent. But if you get these type of one and done players that are NBA guys, like out of the box, out of high school, and they have to go play a year, which I think he's going to get here and there from now on, man, it could be dangerous.
You got to wonder how Mustafa Heron feels, right? I mean, I know he had personal issues. It wasn't just that he was mad or anything. He had his, you know, I think his mother was ill and things like that. But still, you know, he left and he missed out on a Final Four run, and you know, who knows how far we might have gone if he had still been on the team. So I keep wondering. I just feel bad for him, you know. I mean, he made his choice, but, and he did what he had to do, but I kind of feel bad that he was kind of a part of the foundation of this particular team, you know.
You know, I think a lot of, you know, some people said this, and I was one of them. I thought Auburn was going to be a better team without Mustafa. Mustafa didn't necessarily fit the system in that he wanted to take games over. He wasn't the type of guy that would make the extra pass. And the reason why Auburn was so successful this past season is because everybody was so unselfish that they would just pass, pass, pass. And if you're wide open, shoot the ball. They always found the open man. And Mustafa had a tendency to where he would dribble the ball up the court if he got the hold of it and try to make something happen. And sometimes it worked, sometimes it didn't. But when it worked, he'd score, you know, 8 in a row, and you'd be like, oh, okay. And then he'd be quiet for a while. But there would be some wasted possessions in there. And I thought Auburn might actually be helped a little bit by not having him on the roster, which I know almost sounds evil on my part. But I just thought, because of the way Dangelo Purifoy was returning, Austin Wiley was returning to the roster, they had enough to make up for his scoring presence, mm-hmm. but I think that they needed to have that refocused philosophy of that Bruce Pearl preaches all the time. This isn't about you. This isn't about him. This is about him getting his points. Mm-hmm. Everybody's going to get there. Everybody's going to get their moments, and it's true because I remember games this past season where Malik Dunbar would be mad because he didn't quite have the type of game he wanted. And I remember Bruce Pearl telling him after one game, listen, we're going to need you at some point, and you've got to help us because you're going to be the star of the game. And then Malik would have two monster dunks in a game, and it would spark a run, and then you have a big defensive stop. And all of a sudden, Malik Dunbar is probably like the second MVP, if you want to say, in a game. And without him, they don't win in an SEC tournament game. Same goes for Javon McCormick. I mean, this is a kid that came in as a backup point guard. He thought, hey, I could battle and maybe be the starting point guard. I mean, everybody thinks they could be that. But Jared Harper here, he just wasn't going to happen. But then Jared Harper gets in foul trouble in the SEC tournament, and all of a sudden McCormick's thrown out there. He goes from playing at a small junior college in Texas called Lee College to a year later playing the SEC tournament and getting thrown out there. And he leads Auburn to a 10-point lead against Tennessee. And I was just going, where's this been? But it was just – it's Bruce Pearl putting into these guys, listen, you're gonna have your time. You got to be ready. And it's cliche to say that, but it kept happening throughout the season, and the guys knew that at some point they were going to be counted on. And sure enough, down the stretch, when there were injuries and everything, or someone was getting in foul trouble, they had to step in, and they really did their job.
John, do we have any other baseball or basketball questions before we move on to football?
Well, one of them is, are we currently living in the best decade of Auburn sports from, say, right now, from 2010 to 2019? Is this the best decade of Auburn sports ever?
You guys might be better suited to answer that. I mean, seriously, because I wasn't around the 80s. I'm only familiar really with the 90s forward just because of my lifespan, living in the SEC or being around SEC teams. The 1980s were pretty good. I mean, with basketball and football, I mean, obviously with Pat Dye and winning two SEC championships, and probably should have been awarded a national championship. Mm-hmm. Basketball was doing well. Was women's basketball heating up by then?
We had the 3 years, I think it's in the very end of the 80s, where we went to the final four. We went to the final two 3 years in a row. And I want to say that was like 80. I think it was around the same time we were winning the SEC in football. And I think it was right after, maybe. Does that sound right, John? Wasn't it the late 80s, early 90s? It was right.
Oh, yeah. No, it was the Ruthie Bolton and that group was there when we were there.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, because, one of them was in a class with me. The men's run was basically 84 through 88.
Right.
I think the women's run was around like 87, 88, 89, something like that. So, yeah, that's true. That the mid-late 80s are about comparable to where we are now, except that even with Barkley, even with Chuck Person, the best we did was 1 year we went to the Elite Eight, and that was as far as we got. So,
Yeah. I think one could argue that this is the best decade outside of the 80s. I mean, and maybe it will be better than the 80s. And I say that just because there's a football season left, and who knows what will happen. I know everybody's down on football right now, but you never know, especially with that defense they've got. It's incredible what has happened in the big sports for Auburn since 2010. They've been to two national championship games in football. They've won one. Mm-hmm. They've won two SEC titles. They've been to three SEC championship games in football. And by the way, and this is with the asterisk, they're doing it with, I think, the best college football coach ever leading your rival program at Alabama.
Yeah.
And Auburn's managed to do all that in spite of Alabama just having unprecedented success. And the only people who've had success against Alabama during that time is Auburn and Clemson.
Yeah.
That's amazing to me. I know fans don't think that for whatever reason, but, and I know Auburn fans just want to be like, well, we want to be better than Alabama. Certainly you do, but Nick Saban's incredible as a coach. And when you, it's like he gets like 25 first round players every year when he goes recruiting. And Auburn's managed to hold their own against Alabama. They're not winning as much as everybody wants against Alabama, but hey, they when they win and they beat Alabama, it's usually because Auburn's a championship caliber program that year, as we've seen in 2010, 2013, and 2017. So I think what football's done this decade is really incredible. What basketball has done under Bruce Pearl is unprecedented. And I'll say this, I've said this already. Whoever is the coach after Bruce Pearl, whenever that happens, and down the road, I don't think this success will ever be replicated. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I don't think they'll ever get to a Final Four again. I mean, unless, you know, Bruce Pearl somehow turns this into him being here another 10 years and they've go to like two more Final Fours or three more Final Fours during that time, that which would be just outrageous. And he builds Auburn into a program that's like kind of like how Duke started out, you know, Krzyzewski built that up and got it going, and somehow Auburn becomes a powerhouse, like the new powerhouse. That would be remarkable. But it's so difficult to do in the modern age. There's really just it's almost impossible. But the job Bruce Pearl has done, I don't think there's any comparison in Auburn history. I'd have to go back and look. But as far as taking a program that just has never done that before, mm-hmm. and or was built to do that, and to do what he's done over these last 2 years, is incredible to me. And what he's doing now with recruiting is a great example of just what you can do with that. But you got to take advantage. I think the problem that the reason why football has been so inconsistent is that recruiting wise, they haven't really taken advantage of those huge years. They've had top 10 classes or whatever, but they kind of miss still on some of those five-star program changing skill players or some of those guys like, you know, I don't like throwing guys in the bus. Some of those guys don't pan out like Jeremy Johnson. I mean, listen, everybody, national analysts, local guys, we're thinking Jeremy Johnson might be a Heisman candidate going into 2015. Instead, he's nearly losing to Jacksonville State that year. So you just never know sometimes, but you got to capitalize when you have that success. And the only way to capitalize is by doing it on the recruiting trail. It's not about, well, you know, Bruce Pearl's a great coach, so he'll do this with any talent. No, you still got to have the talent. And I think what Pearl's doing, if he can cap what I think he's going to do in 2020 and 2021 recruiting, what he's doing is he's not only taking Auburn to the next level on the court, but he's about to take Auburn to the next level with the talent level. And if you can start keep winning with that and doing that, you've opened a whole new, brand new door that was never available to Auburn. And if you open that door, you can keep it open. There's no one there to shut it for you. You're the one who's going to shut it or keep it open as a coach.
Well, speaking of quarterbacks, I for one think that, you know, we've got so many returning starters in football this coming in this fall. We've got, I mean, if anything, the offensive line should be better at running back than we were last year. The receivers are a year older, pretty much most of them back. Everything looks as good or better, with the possible exception, and I say possible because I don't know this is 100%, you know, true, that the quarterback situation is kind of the mystery. I think it's a mystery. You'd hate to say that a senior like Jarrett Stidham is worse than a freshman coming in. I mean, he was a very good quarterback, obviously. He's in the NFL now, but but at least for Gus's system and what we're trying to do, and in terms of doing something besides just passing the ball, there's a good possibility that one of our two freshman quarterbacks could be better in this system, better for Auburn. And so do you think that will we see both of those quarterbacks in the first game? How do you think this is all going to play out in terms of quarterback?
I think we will see both quarterbacks in the opener against Oregon. I think at some point, though, you got to settle with a main starter. How they'd go about that, it remains to be seen. But I think both will play early. I think a lot of the expectation right now, even among those on the staff, you know, secretly, so to speak, is that they're sitting there thinking either Joey Gatewood is just going to be absolutely dominant and a big surprise to people as a runner, inside zone guy, and a passer, that he'll take over the job. Or it's going to be a situation where Bo Nix is the starter and Joey Gatewood's like a red zone quarterback, package quarterback type. But that remains to be seen. I've heard coaches off to the side talking with me think of it both ways. But they won't know until they get through practice in August and they realize this guy's a little bit more consistent, or this one's not, or, you know. But if they're both sharing snaps pretty equally in that opener, that's because neither of them blossomed and out showcased the other. If one of them's starting and the other's a package guy, that's because the other one definitely won that job in practice. But I say that to say this. Everybody can make predictions. Coaches are, you know, closer to these kids than anybody else. They get paid to look at everything, and they have unprecedented access to them. No one's going to know until they play a few games. That it's just a fact, and it's difficult to do that against the schedule and with freshman quarterbacks. But I don't think there's any way Auburn's going to be able to figure out exactly who their starting quarterback is and then be comfortable with that player until about like three games get burned off the calendar.
John?
That's fair. Staying with football, this is a question from Joey Miller, who says, looking at Oregon's offensive line, will they be able to block Auburn's front seven? I mean, Oregon's offensive line is getting some love nationally, but are they that good? Auburn needs to win the battle there, in my view. He doesn't like Auburn's chances if we have to try to win a shootout with a freshman quarterback in their first game, away from home especially.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting you bring up that point about Oregon's offensive line getting so much love nationally. I brought that up to an Oregon beat writer for a Q&A we did on our website, and he said, yeah, this idea that Oregon's got the best or maybe one of the best national offensive lines, in the nation, he doesn't believe that. Now, they might have one of the better ones in the Pac-12, he said, but he doesn't believe they're one of the better ones in the nation. What's going to be so fun to watch in this game is not necessarily the quarterbacks going against each other, or, you know, who's got the better game there with Justin Herbert, a potential first round guy, or Auburn's two freshman quarterbacks. It's going to be the trenches, man. It's going to be Oregon's offensive line against Auburn's defensive line and vice versa, because both units for both teams are pretty good. And I don't quite know who will have the advantage. As I look at it now, I would think Auburn's going to have the advantage on both sides in the trenches, in my opinion. But the one area of concern for me for Auburn, which not a lot of people are talking about, I think, is who's going to be the defensive tackle that starts next to Derrick Brown, because they haven't figured that out yet, and they don't know who it's going to be. Tyrone Truesdale, you assume he'd step in, but Tyrone Truesdale's not built to play 30 snaps a game. He's just not. And so they're going to have to use a system where they rotate a lot of guys in next to Derrick Brown. Or what I think might end up happening is they take a guy like Nick Coe, a defensive end, a pass rusher type, and he's bulked up a little bit, and they move him inside in some packages and try to take the load off of Tyrone Truesdale, you know, Aconis Miller and all those guys. So I think there's going to be a lot of rotation at the tackle spot. But the question is can they have a dominant player like they had with Dontavius Russell playing next to Derrick Brown? Derrick Brown's going to be a first-round guy, a top-10 guy this upcoming year. But Dontavius Russell made him so much better last season, because Dontavius Russell demanded double teams at times, and he barely ever blew assignments. And that's going to be a big loss for Auburn. But one man doesn't make a defensive line, particularly in the interior. So Auburn's defensive line is going to be great, I think, this season. But if they want to be elite and be the best, they've got to figure something else out at that other tackle spot. And they're going to be working hard to figure that out in August.
I was going to say, Dontavius Russell was really underrated because he didn't make a lot of sacks or tackles for losses. I think people didn't notice it, but he occupied offensive linemen and kept them off the linebackers and allowed them to do their job really freely. And that was very, very valuable. And he plugged the holes where the running backs were trying to run up the middle. So he was a valuable player. And those guys don't, like you're saying, it may take three or four guys rotating to replace him with what they got out of just him. So.
Yeah, I mean, Kevin Steele told me that, you know, he's a guy that he was the glue that held them all together last year. He said, because they'd watch tape and he would sit there and think, there's one, he turned to people and go, there's one guy whose name I have not called out here today. And usually a coach is only calling out when they're reviewing tape in a meeting because there's a missed assignment. And it's Dontavius Russell. He said it was like that every week. He goes, he was the one player's name I never said after watching tape. And it was because he was just like so good at his job that, you know, that gets overlooked because you're not making mistakes. And it's like that for offensive linemen particularly, but also defensive linemen. You only get noticed when you mess up, you know, when a quarterback gets sacked or a running back gets hit for a loss or, you know, a defensive lineman blows an assignment and a guy blows past him, a running back blows past him because of a good block. So Dontavius Russell wasn't that type of player. He was barely noticed, and the reason why he's barely noticed is because he was so, so good.
Yeah, it has to be something really spectacular for an offensive lineman to on the good side. So what should we be most worried about this upcoming football season then? I mean, is it the quarterback, or is there some area, or is it that interior of the defensive line, or is there some other area that – I mean, I know that for next year, obviously, we're going to have to start worrying about the offensive line, and we're trying to – there was some success on that today, in fact, I believe. But what's the main thing we should be worrying about that we haven't already talked about?
Receivers. I know the receivers – especially Seth Williams and Matthew Hill, as we saw in the A-Day game. They had good A-Day games. But I kept being told in the spring, and then even after the A-Day game, by people I trust implicitly, that they do not have a game breaker at receiver right now, and that's holding them back as far as what they can do offensively. Having said that, they got a lot of talent. They've got guys that can make plays, but they don't have a real big down-the-field threat to replace Darius Slayton. That's why they were trying to go after graduate transfers and end up landing one. They want a guy that's an instant impact guy down the field because they don't have that. They didn't have that on the team, and it remains to be seen if this pans out with the grad transfer. But that was the one area in the spring that I was told that was very inconsistent was the receiver spot. And then I was told again after A-Day, I was like, man, they look pretty good out there. He goes, don't let that fool you. They were set up for success. We told them we're going to throw the ball a lot. That amped them up, and the defensive backs, they weren't quite playing, you know, what they were going to be playing on game day, so to speak, the defense. So there is some concern there among the coaches about the receivers. So outside of quarterback, there's obviously some issues there. They got to work out with the receivers. And listen, it's going to be difficult. It's difficult just at face value to replace Darius Slayton, who is your down the field guy. And also Ryan Davis, who was a record breaker and a good safety valve for you in the screen game. So they're going to need not two guys to step up in their place. They're going to need four. I mean, they need guys all across the field to step up because not only do they have to replace that production, but also they've got to help out these first-time starters or starter at quarterback because they're going to have to make these quarterbacks look better than they are early in their careers. It's like that with any freshman quarterback. They got to have good receivers to have a good passing game. And you have to have guys that can catch the balls that maybe are 50-50 balls, not necessarily, you know, high arcing passes or whatever, get out, jump your guy. But 50-50 balls where it's a low throw and you readjust, or it's thrown behind you, you readjust, and you make the catch. That's what they need out of these receivers. And that wasn't quite what was happening in spring practices, I was told.
That surprises me. John, what is your reaction to that?
I mean, I get it. It's, you know, when you have Stidham was good, and you have replacing him with inexperienced quarterbacks, and so the ball isn't going to be exactly where it's supposed to be all the time, and the receivers have to adjust and make the plays. But also, like, they have to – I mean, the position that Slayton played is the one where you have to get off the line of scrimmage, where you're going to be pressed a lot, and you got to be able to get off the line of scrimmage against tight coverage and go. And he could do that. And I don't know if that's one of the reasons they took this grad transfer receiver, is I don't think they had anybody on the roster that they felt could do that against tight coverage.
No, you're exactly right. Sorry about that. Yeah, you're exactly right. That's why I think after the first week and a half or so of spring practices, I was being told by sources there with the football program, hey, we're looking for a grad transfer guy. If you know of anybody, let us know. I'm like, hey, you're asking the wrong guy. He goes, well, we're asking everybody. We're looking. We got to get some help. So you're exactly right. They had to find someone to fill that Darius Slayton spot. We'll see if this new guy is going to be the answer for them, but we'll see. But that's been a big area for them in trying to correct. But also, as I mentioned earlier, getting other receivers to step up when there's some maybe difficult to catch balls that the great to elite receivers can adjust to and make plays, because that's what they recruited these guys to do. And that isn't quite what was happening in the spring. And they're wanting some better production out of them.
That's interesting. What else we got, John?
All right, our next question comes from AU Tweep, and it's in response to Bill Connolly tweeted out he was working on the Auburn preview. He hasn't published it yet because he's still in the Pac-12, I think. But he put out a graph basically showing Auburn's win probability, basically saying that Auburn was going to be a top 8 team in his rankings. But because the schedule was so tough, they were projected to go 8-4 because the schedule had so many tough games in it. And so his question is, how do we feel about the win projections? Some seem too low, like he only had us having like a 40% chance to win at Florida, but some seem too high, like it's like basically a 70% chance to beat Oregon. And then what's the fan reaction if Auburn goes 8-4?
I think more than anything, it depends on what 8 games they've won.
Yeah,
I said that last year too. But if they win 8 games and won those games against Georgia, I don't know. I don't want to act like I could speak for fans, but considering the schedule, it's pretty good. Because you got to play a top 15 Oregon team. You're probably going to play a top 15 Florida team on the road. Then there's obviously LSU, Alabama, Georgia. I think both Mississippi schools are definitely, but they should be wins. You lose one of those, then it's like, well, what's happening? Yeah. I had a funny anecdote shared with me by someone, on Auburn's staff. They were out recruiting. And one of these recruits was just talking to him and just bluntly asked him, how many games you guys have to win next year? Because there's a lot of negative recruiting out there from other coaching staffs about, well, your coach is not going to be there. You know, they don't win this amount of games or whatever. And the coach just replied bluntly to the recruit, we have to win 2 games. And the recruit was like confused, like, what? What do you mean? He goes, We just have to beat Georgia and Alabama. And what he was saying, what he told him was, it's not that we have to beat both of them and then everything's fine. It's just that that's the expectation at Auburn, that they have to beat both of them every year. And that just doesn't happen outside of those years. Auburn gets them both at home here recently. And Auburn gets that opportunity here this year with Alabama and Georgia both at home. But I think totally, even if they go 8-4, like you said, I mean, they might be the number 8 team as S&P Plus has them, and then they might only win 8 games because of that schedule. I just think that it's difficult sometimes for fans that want to be in the national championship every year or in the playoff every year to swallow the pill of, well, the rest of the SEC is pretty good, and winning 8 games is not necessarily a bad thing. Particularly, by the way, when you've got a freshman quarterback and maybe some issues at receiver, as I said. But, you know, we'll see. I'm kind of torn on what's going to happen with this team, and the reason why is because, man, quarterback plays everything in the SEC, man. Unless you have an elite running back and an elite backup running back, it depends on how good your quarterback is, whether you're going to be a program that wins 9 games or more. And I don't know, because it's freshmen, and you just never know about freshmen until they get out there.
That's right. Made me think of something, but it slipped my mind now. What about the football only building? I know that you just did a report on your show last week or a few days ago that there has finally been a little movement on it. Kind of give us, if you don't mind, an update on what's going on and what we should expect about building that thing.
I think the Board of Trustees more or less said, hey, Mr. President, get out of the way. Let's get this done. You know, it was a very interesting week. 1 week before, the Board of Trustees told the president, hey, you need to form a working committee and start moving forward with this football-only complex. 1 week before that, I tracked down President Stephen Leith at the SEC spring meetings in Destin, and he was literally running upstairs trying to avoid me. And I managed to get him to stop and answer a couple of questions for 2.5 minutes. And so he told me, listen, football complex is not on the agenda. I do not expect any conversations about it until September. And I was kind of taken aback by that, because by all the sources I've been talking to and everything, was that June was kind of the target date of things moving forward. And sure enough, it wasn't on the agenda, but the board brought it up because they had met one of their committees. Their facilities committees had met and said, hey, we've been reading about this football facility and everything, and let's bring it up in the public setting here and talk to Stephen Leith and say, hey, we know you guys are working on this. We know there's been some fundraising. We're okay with it. We want it done. Let's get moving. So go do this for us and then come back to us for any approvals you want. And I think there was two things that happened that will happen as a result of this. One, It was a signal to the president, listen, stop dragging your feet on athletic stuff. This can't keep happening here. Number two, the board pretty much said, whatever you bring to us, we're going to rubber stamp. We don't care about money right now with this. It needs to be done. It's number one priority for athletics. And it's been a number one priority for Alan Green, the athletics director, for a year now. I've been talking to him since last summer about how he's been working on this from a fundraising perspective. And I've been told by sources that are close to the administrators in the athletics department that I think I reported a month ago, maybe it was a little bit longer, that they had either approached the 50% mark with fundraising, or they had surpassed it. And I was told that they were aiming to raise about $30 million because they expect the facility to be maybe about $60 million, which is how much Clemson and South Carolina's facilities cost. Recently, we heard that it might be up as much as $80 million. I don't think that's going to be the case. In fact, if you look through the past here, especially the last decade, Auburn's managed with their athletics facilities to always come under budget. Auburn Arena was way under budget when it was all done. I know that was a while back, but you look at the wellness kitchen they built, the dorms, all that stuff. So, I think $60 million is what they're kind of aiming for and what they're expecting to spend. And now that this happened at the Board of Trustees meeting here in early June, I suspect that by the time September rolls around, that's when Auburn will go up to them and go, hey, we want approval to enter the design phase and hire a design firm and all that. And then they'll be rolling down the hill. And the timelines I've been told was design phase would take about a year. and then construction will take about another year. So whenever they get approval for design phase, 2 years from about right then is when that Auburn Athletics Complex for football should be opening. So you're probably looking at, my guess would be, sometime maybe as early as before the 2021 football season. But I would suspect it may actually be during the off season after the 21 season, and it would be fully operational before the 2022 season.
And do you think that we'll go the route of like Clemson with all the bells and whistles and entertainment stuff about it, or is that just kind of their thing? Or I just can't quite figure out, you know, if that's something that everybody needs to be doing now, or if it's just kind of a one-off.
I don't think it's a one-off, just because South Carolina, I mean, they got a recording studio in their football complex. And then obviously with Clemson, you know, they got a miniature golf course and the big slide that's in there. Mm. I think Auburn will have some fun stuff in there. But I remember a year ago when I talked to Gus Malzahn about the football facility, I said, what do you want in there? And he said, I want something that's Auburn.
Yeah.
And that to me meant that it doesn't need to be something where we've got to sell our program by saying, hey, we've got a slip and slide inside. I do think, though, and I don't want to talk too much about this, but I think that this building is going to be state of the art on the inside, and they're going to get some good help with that from some very notable people. That's all I'll say.
Oh, yeah. I think we know some of the notable people. That's good. John, any last questions from the listeners you want to throw out?
Well, the last one I want to ask is, basically, a combination of a couple questions that comes down to, does the current athletic director, Alan Green, get some credit for what's happened in the athletic programs under his leadership? And does Jay Jacobs get any of the credit because of what he did to bring some of these people into place?
Well, you know, I think it's a mix of both, but let's go case by case basis. Baseball. That was almost like a corrective measure by Jay Jacobs, because he hired Sonny Galloway and then fired him and did so with really what was kind of should have been a controversial move. I mean, he fired him so late in the process, right before a season. And then he managed to get Butch Thompson, and it course corrected everything. So that's a Jay Jacobs thing, but it came at a price of he hired the wrong guy in the first place. You know, Alan Green hasn't had a big hire yet. So you can't really judge him off any of the success that's going on. Now, having said that, with basketball success, Alan Green has been very strong in his support of Bruce Pearl while all this controversy and stuff have been surrounding him. And they've done everything in their power to make Bruce Pearl feel comfortable and not feel like he's being distracted so he could do his job. Same with the players. And I think Alan Green and his staff deserve a lot of credit for that. And Rich McGlynn, who is the director of compliance at Auburn, has done a fantastic job for Auburn in protecting Auburn, one, but also, two, helping Alan Green and others to make sure that they protect the players and these coaches and go through all this red tape to figure out if they're safe or not, or to make sure that they can play or that they are safe. So I think that Alan deserves a lot of credit for helping basketball stay in a spot where it can be successful and continue to build toward it, even though there was some outside noise going on, even well after Chuck Person was arrested on those FBI, those six federal charges. So outside that, I mean, I think the first thing you're really going to be able to judge Alan on is going to be a football facility, because that's been his baby since he's been here. And we just talked about it. And if what I'm hearing is correct, I mean, that thing's going to be special, guys. I think Alan's done Alan's done a lot of work behind the scenes very quietly that, if it all pans out, is going to be incredible. But every AD is judged by their hires. Ultimately, that's how every AD's tenure ends or begins. That, or they did something illegal, or you know, they are just having too many violations under their watch. Mm-hmm. But Allen Green hasn't had that big hire yet, and you know, we'll see if he gets that opportunity or not. It could happen with football after this year or next year, or it might not. Basketball, you know, unless something crazy happens, Bruce Pearl's going to be here a while. baseball, Butch Thompson's going to be here a while. So Allen Green's in a pretty good spot, and it's because of Jay Jacobs. I mean, like him or not, you know, athletic directors have their failures and they have their successes, but for the most part, late in Jay Jacobs' tenure, that he swung big, man, for hires. He just did. Sonny Galloway at the time was a big hire, though I didn't quite agree with it. Bruce Pearl was a huge hire. And listen, weeks before they fired Tony Barbee and then went on to get Bruce Pearl, I was hearing from people inside that athletics department about how they were already vetting Bruce Pearl and being prepared to go after him. While Tony Barbee was still employed. So, and that's Jay Jacobs. He was prepared for it, and he managed to convince Bruce Pearl to come. And if he didn't do it at that time, immediately after Auburn lost that SEC tournament, I'm not sure Bruce Pearl would be here today. And the reason I say that is not necessarily, well, I don't want to go to Auburn because it's Auburn. I say it because the Boston College job was about to come open. And if the timing had just been off a few days, mm-hmm. Bruce Pearl may have been the coach at Boston College. Mm. I don't know if Boston College would have shown interest, but he's an alum. His show cause was about to end. Boston College wanted to get back on the winning track. And literally, I remember the day Bruce Pearl was on the plane headed to Auburn to be introduced, the Boston College job came open. And I remember texting someone in the athletics department, did Bruce sign his contract? Because the Boston College job just came open. And I know crazy stuff happens, but I just need to make sure. And he's like, oh, he ain't going there.
Does he have a parachute? Does he have a parachute with him just in case he's going to jump out of the plane?
Yeah. He's like, yeah, we're in Bristol, Connecticut. I'm going to have to parachute right now after working here at ESPN and you picking me up.
Oh, man.
I'm not doing this. But
can you imagine?
But that was Jay Jacobs. Jay Jacobs made that hire happen. And, man, did it work out. So Allen Green, we'll see. He's got to make, you know, every AD is judged by their hires. And, you know, he just, because of circumstance, he hasn't had an opportunity, or I would say, I wouldn't say opportunity. I would say for him, I'm sure he's very happy he hadn't had to make any changes, because what he can do is just build off of what was, you know, handed to him, so to speak. And from there, make everything better. And I think one of those things, as I said, is a football facility. And he's in position to do that because of Jay Jacobs. I know some fans will just, you know, anything Jay Jacobs touches, they think's crap. But I think Jay Jacobs left Auburn in pretty good shape.
Yeah. No, I agree. I think there's something to be said for letting other programs build those facilities first, because you get a sense of what works and what doesn't, and what you have to, you know, what you should expect to pay and what the return would be. I mean, you know, on the one hand, there's the advantage. If you've got it early, you can take advantage of it early, and Clemson certainly has done that. But I think there's an upside to, you know, kind of hanging back though and seeing what we want to do, like you said, to make it, like Gus said, to make it Auburn. So, you know, maybe this will in the long run be beneficial. You know, like we have the giant video board that we have because a couple of other schools made some, and then we said, okay, let's use that as the starting point, you know, and go.
I'll say this though, in my mm-hmm. personal opinion, that was a big misfire by Jay Jacobs. Mm-hmm. I think that big video board was a huge mistake, mm-hmm. and because one, I think it's lessened the atmosphere for games that are not huge games at Auburn, because people are just paying attention to that screen. Mm-hmm. Now, once the Iron Bowl and everything, they're not paying much attention to it. They're still wild. But it's affected the atmosphere. And two, that thing, as big as it is not completely visible everywhere in the stadium. People in those skyboxes and stuff, in those suites, they can't see it. Which is incredible to me to think about, but it's true. I heard that, and I went inside some of those things, and I went, oh my gosh. It's just like your vision's so focused on the football field, which is good. You can't see the video screen. You literally have to walk outside this room to see it. I think it's too big. I think it just it envelops everything. And if you guys have been to several games, I don't know if you have since that screen's been there at night. It is so bright, and it's so distracting. I honestly don't know how like players deal with it on the field, because they'll be showing like a graphic on there that's orange and white, like flickering on and off to try and mess with the opposing team. And it's like, it's illuminating the entire stadium and the grass and everything. And it's just, it's like being in a club. I don't know how they deal with it. But anyway, I know you brought that up, but I went a little long winded there. They should have done something better with that video board. It's like I put a giant Band-Aid on the stadium, because there's so many other things that stadium needs improvements with, and adding a video board is not one of them.
No, that's interesting. That's certainly what we call a hot take, right? I mean, I hadn't thought about it that way. I mean, I know that people have said it's ridiculously big and all that, but I hadn't thought of it in terms that it actually like detracts, you know, in some ways from the experience. That's very interesting. All right, and now before we get into our final segment with Brandon, we have to, of course, thank our patrons who keep our programs on the air. Shows like this would not exist without the generous support of folks like the following people who, for as little as a dollar a month, pay our bills, keep the lights on in the Palatial White Rocket Studios, and allow us to bring you all these various programs and more. You can join their ranks and help us to help you with these shows by going to www.auwishbone.com. Just go to www.auwishbone.com and click on the link to become a patron. On that page, you can also access our We Believed series of special audio programs where we're going through the entire history of Auburn football, going back to Shug Jordan in the 1970s. Episodes 1 through, I believe, 4 are there now. And episode 5 is coming very soon. We're working on episode 6 right now out of a 10-episode mini-series. You can go and find that also at auwishbone.com. Our current patrons include Brendan O'Dwyer, Samuel Salvatore, Christopher Burleson, and Carl Von Drunker, as well as Phil Amthor, Winston Boddy, Willie Carden, Susan Trawick, Ben Spooner, Stephen Thompson, Chris Usher, Justin Bean, Steve Trawick, and Richard Stevens, Clarence Alford, David Hegler, Robert Mendenhall, Johnny Caldwell, Reynolds Wolf, Joshua Corbett, Valiant Hermes, Jacob and Robin Fleming, Clay Henson, Ann Kangian, Catherine England, George Gaston, Will Summerford, John McCune, Tom Anderson, and also David Evers, Andrew Barber, Timothy, Steve Harlan, Dan Thompson, Wes Atkinson, Rich Reimer, Jared Albrick, William Glenn Matthews, Joel Beckham, Theodore Gary, Shannon Butson, Taylor Sanford, Mickey B., Hugh Anderson, Shane Bailey, Mick Vigicana, Chris Thrash, Logan Chilton, Tony Perry, Alex Wynn, Josh Teal, David Simpson, Earl Ricks, Mike Finley, C.T. Wayne, and Dave Powell. And then there's Jeremy Minton, Lane Middleton, Donnie Reynolds, Wade Carson, Ivor Evans, John Zavachin, Chris Camo, Darren Pyle, Chris Wardam Wade, Jason Albrick, Randall Walker, Ben Amos, Ruth and Darren Sutherland, Patrick Williams, Rob Morgan, Stephen Schuster, James Taylor, John Stubbs, Kenneth Brent Rains, Nicholas Craig, Russell Milling, Matthew Wagstaff. Oh, we're almost to the end. Joey Miller, Mark Squire, Spanky, Brant Rumble, J.W. Rice, Michael Morton, Lawrence Kane, good old Surfer Chickify, and our other one-time and multiple-time and anonymous donors. We thank you all, and you can gain all sorts of benefits and be part of the family by going to www.auwishbone.com. Now back to Brandon, where we're going to bring in our final topic of the night, and one that we do every year about this time, where we talk about the other stuff we love in the entertainment world. So here we go. John, any last questions or thoughts before we do our usual last little short segment about pop culture stuff with Brandon before we let him go?
No, I'm ready to go there.
Let's do it. All right. Well, Brandon, as we always do, our last little bit with you is where we talk about our other favorite things. And we have a long history with you talking about stuff like Batman and the DC stuff and the Marvel stuff. And I know you're more of a DC man. Well, it looks like DC's kind of rebooting everything now. And are you happy about that? What do you think about where DC's going with their movies and stuff now? And this new Batman?
I think it's an interesting approach that they're really just going back to the way things were in the 90s, except they're just going to make more movies. You know, it doesn't seem like there's going to be any connective tissue to any of the movies they're making. I think, there's some interesting choices they've made as far as directors and producers are bringing on board for some of these projects. It'll be interesting to me to see if they try to connect this at some point, if like all these movies are really successful and they're like, oh man, we got to do some big team up movie at some point. But I think they're just more or less, kind of in that mode of it being 1989 again with Batman. There's different, I mean, listen, they've got a Joker movie coming out in October that's set in the 80s and obviously is not connected to the horrible Jared Leto Joker of Suicide Squad. They're doing a soft reboot of the Suicide Squad with James Gunn, who directed the Guardians of the Galaxy movies, and some of the same actors are in it, but they're pretty much trying to say, hey, that first movie didn't happen and the popular people that you like are in this movie. That's which cool. is interesting. And I just think they're going to go forward with this where, like, they're not going to mention Batman or anything like that, because this Batman movie that's coming out, it's obviously not connected to the storyline in Suicide Squad or Joker, because we already seen Batman in the Suicide Squad movie, and it was Ben Affleck, and he was the older Batman, whereas Robert Pattinson's Batman that is going to be made by... Oh, I forgot the director's name.
I don't remember either.
That movie is going to be solely focused on him. It's not going to even connect the tissue to anything. And I've been reading some interesting stuff about that Batman movie. There's like this theory out there that people believe that it might be a Batman movie set in the 50s.
Really?
Yeah, because the director keeps saying, I'm making a detective noir story. That's what I'm doing. And people believe he's not just, you could do that no matter the time period. I mean, right. Look at Blade Runner and Blade Runner 2049. It doesn't matter what year it is. It's everybody thinks of noir and they go, oh, it's 1940s or whatever. But there's some folks that I've read that are close to the studio and everything, saying that this might be a movie that's a time period. That's a different time period. It's not current day, which is interesting to me. I don't know what to make of it. I think what they're doing is they've realized the Zack Snyder stuff was just terrible. And what he did that may have worked, like Wonder Woman and, really, that's it. We'll keep around and just kind of rework, and then we'll introduce new things. But I think they're off to a good start. Aquaman was okay. It was a little bloated, but at least it was a comic book movie.
It wasn't bad. It was pretty good. It wasn't the greatest thing ever, but it was good. It was solid.
Yeah, I mean, they at least tried to stick with the stuff you saw in the comics, and they didn't shy away from it being cheesy and weird, because that's what Aquaman is. Sure. I think they're just pretty much what they're pretty much going for is what you see in comic books today and have seen for 30 plus years. Is you might have, and I'd love to see this personally, if they're going to go this route, you might have three different Batman comics, going on. I would love it, and I know Kevin Smith's brought this up before, he would love it if they released a Batman movie every year, and each of them was different and not tied together. It was like 1 year they release a $30 million detective Batman piece with like no special effects, and it's just like a small, like, independent type thing. And then 2 years later, they do a bigger Batman movie set in a different, you know, time period later in his career or whatever, where you kind of tell, you can either tell the stories of the same Batman, but in different stages of his career, mm-hmm. or you could just do different offshoots of Batman and different, you know, Elseworlds, say Elseworlds, I guess, or whatever you want to say. Why not? I mean, you can go to the comic book store and, you know, pick out any comic you want, whether it's, you know, the current iteration or the several iterations of it that are current right now, or you can go buy a comic from the a run in the late 1980s that you really liked or whatever. Mm-hmm. Why not do that with film? I mean, Batman's Batman. Like, pretty much anybody's going to go see that, unless it's just complete crap. And so anyway, Warner Brothers is going with this idea of, let's get great directors and let them just tell their own stories. And I think they'll worry about it. Maybe we'll connect it all at some point, but maybe not. And I think they're okay with that because, they're going to make their money back, you know, hand over fist if these movies are good. That's all that matters. I think Wonder Woman proved that. Aquaman, to a certain extent, especially overseas, proved that because it was so successful overseas and it made a lot of money and they're making a sequel. Shazam, which was like kind of a smaller movie. It had a budget of $80 million, which sounds like a lot, but for a comic book movie, it's not. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you guys saw that. I really liked it. I thought it was really good.
Yeah, that was great.
So, yeah, I'm a DC guy. It's just I kind of like the idea that let's just go make good movies on our individual characters and not worry about making a Justice League movie or, you know, Justice League Dark movie or any of that stuff. Let's just go make good stuff. So for that matter, I'm interested in the Joker movie because Joaquin Phoenix is an amazing actor. Todd Phillips is not a great director, so that's got me worried. You know, Wonder Woman 1984, I think, is going to be great. Just because Patty Jenkins is a very good director and Chris Pine was like the heart and soul of that first movie to me. And I thought he was great. And I'm interested to see how they utilize him in this, even though he's quote unquote dead, but he's in the movie. I'm trying to think what else. The Suicide Squad, I don't really care all that much. The Harley Quinn movie that's coming out, I don't know if I care all that much, but maybe they will make me care if it's a good movie. But they just, I think they've realized we can't be putting the cart in front of the horse like we did with Zack Snyder, where we go, all right, you made Man of Steel. It didn't quite make the type of money we want. So let's start doing a Marvel thing. You've got two That's movies it. To get to Justice League.
That's it. You don't need to try to out-Marvel Marvel. You're DC. The thing that makes DC great is those iconic characters and all the different stories you can tell with them. And that's a completely, I mean, people look at the superficiality and say, okay, it's just like Marvel. So let's just do the same thing Marvel's doing and we'll make the same kind of money and have the same kind of artistic and, you know, success. But what makes DC great, like you said, is having these different characters, you know, in the 40s and the 50s and the 80s, you know, different. They don't have to tie together. That's Marvel's shtick. Let Marvel do Marvel and you do DC. I think it's why, you know, one of the reasons why DC's animated stuff was so good for the last 30 years is because,
oh yes,
for the most part, they had no pressure, and so they could just do whatever they wanted. There was no pressure of you must do exactly what Marvel's doing. It was like, you know, you want to do Red Sun, you know, with Superman, or you want to do the Dark Knight Returns, or you want to do, you know, what, Gaslight, Gotham under Gaslight, or whatever. Just, you know, do it and don't worry about connecting all. So that's. Yeah, if they will do themselves.
I like that stuff.
Yeah, if they would do themselves and not try to be something else, I think that's definitely a good move.
Yeah, and I kind of, like I said, I like that approach of just do different iterations of the character and try stuff out. And listen, it's going to make money. And at some point, like, why not? I mean, everybody was like talking about, is it going to be Robert Pattinson or Nicholas Holt as the next Batman? It's like, how about you make them both Batman? Let one of them go do a Batman set in the 1980s and one set in the whatever, or, you know, do a Gotham by Gaslight. Can you imagine a Gotham by Gaslight movie? It would never be made, but why not make it?
Sure.
Go make it.
Absolutely.
Make it some steampunk awesome. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Yes.
You know, and like you said, and there's so many iterations of these characters, and then like it's like that somewhat with Marvel, but I mean, the Flash, you know, isn't just Barry Allen, you know. You know, Batman's always Bruce Wayne, so to speak. But, you know, I would like to finally see a Batman movie about how he came across Robin and how that was his own way of fixing him. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And trying to find a family of his own. So we have never seen that before. I mean, they had Robin in those other Batman movies in the 90s, but they were so awful. They didn't quite connect with you as far as that.
No.
Okay. You know, there's a hole in Bruce Wayne, and he's psychotic, but he's psychotic and he still manages to find his own family and the whole Bat family stuff. But, you know, that's something that has to be built, I guess, maybe earned over several movies. So maybe we won't see that. But I think you could do a movie where Batman, you know, discovers Robin, and the whole movie isn't necessarily centered around the villain of the week. It's centered around why Robin is with him, and why Robin maybe thinks the guy's a little crazy, but why is he, you know, so attached to him, and why they see so much of each other in each other. And I think it could be a weird movie to do. But anyway, so I'm getting off track there. But the big thing for me, I think, is that I don't want to see another Batman origin movie. Yeah. There's no point.
No kidding.
I mean, don't do it. And the director has promised that that's not what this is going to be. It's going to be like year two or whatever.
Yeah.
You know, he is who he is, and he's growing. And the whole story is about him discovering that he's got to be a better detective. And I like that idea, that it's his early goings. And I think he could do good stuff with that, where, you know, he comes back from training and all this stuff, thinks he's great at that, and he can win with his fists. But come to find out, no, to get Gotham back the way you want it, you've got to be a better detective, and you've got to work with your mind. And I think that could be a good good approach with this Robert Pattinson movie, because I think Robert Pattinson's a fantastic actor, mm-hmm. and I think it's great casting. I really do. But it just depends on what they do, because I've read so much about this movie and how they've had so many rewrites and how the studio wants three villains in it.
Oh boy! Mm.
I mean, really? Mm. They want the Penguin, Catwoman, and
oh boy,
who's the other? The Riddler.
I was going to say the Riddler usually is in that crowd. Yeah. So
yeah, they wanted those three in there, and he was wanting two.
Yeah.
And he'd been riding with two, and because it made sense to him based off what he was doing in his world, as far as with a detective story. But yeah, we'll see. Yeah. But I'm just get good directors, man, and make good movies. And you know, I listen to these guys on YouTube with Red Letter Media. They're kind of out there. They're kind of like against the establishment types, and they're very vulgar. But they always make some really good points when it comes to the comic books when it comes to comic books being on film. Mm-hmm. And I mean, they predicted this DC stuff failing the moment Man of Steel came out. I mean, they were talking about it's going to be a couple of years, and we're going to have a Justice League movie. Just watch, because they're so impatient. Sure enough, you know, because back then, after Man of Steel came out, the talk was Man of Steel 2.
Right.
But then that quickly changed like 2 months later when the box office returns came, and they went, oh, we got to do Batman v Superman. But but they said something interesting recently that and I kind of agree with. I think Avengers Endgame mm-hmm. is going to be the last true comic book blockbuster, in that it, you know, a one that just breaking records. Mm-hmm. I don't. How do you repeat what they just did?
No.
How do you repeat? You can't. I don't think they can.
No, I agree completely.
I mean, there's a wealth of characters certainly to pick from, but they use the characters that people are most familiar with, and they built it around that. Mm-hmm. Even though I would, you know, Iron Man's definitely not an A-list hero in the comics, but they did make him an A-list guy in the films,
sure.
and it worked. But really, can you do that again? I don't think so.
No.
No.
I just don't think you can.
No, and everything Marvel's doing over the next 2 or 3 years is back small again. You know, it's like a Black Panther think, 2 or
I was
Doctor
ask,
Strange.
I wanted to get your take on this. Mm-hmm. Do you think that, yeah, they're doing the smaller stuff, but do you think that they're going to be doing stuff that's like spread across a multiverse or timelines where things maybe are connected, but maybe that doesn't make sense. And then maybe later down the road, they can connect it somehow, some way through a movie, but they're more or less just going to work through their characters through either different multiverses or timelines and focus more on their characters. Kind of like what I'm saying with DC, yeah. But in a way that still makes sense because they've opened the door to the multiverse to where they can easily connect that again, I think, with some, because they've got great writers and a great, you know, hive mind there, so to speak, with Kevin Feige, that they could connect it all somehow, some way, and it would make sense. Well, what do you think they're going to do? Do you think it's still all going to be connected?
No. I look at this. Bear in mind that they didn't have much of this planned until about the halfway point that they just did. A lot of it was retrofitted. I mean, you know, when Thanos first appeared at the end of Avengers in 2012, they had no idea what they were going to do with him. They just wanted to have somebody at the end that was different from Loki, that was kind of over the grandmaster of it all. And Joss Whedon says, well, how about Thanos? Thinking they'd say no. And they go, sure. And he's like, oh, crap, I get to put Thanos in there. So they could have just as easily said no, and he'd have been like, oh, okay. And it could have been freaking Kang or something, you know. So they kind of retroactively made it up as they went along, as they got closer to realizing they were making one big story. You know, they're calling it like the Infinity Saga now, but like 3 years ago, they wouldn't have called it that. They wouldn't have really known that's what was, you know, what was coming. So I think that they might throw some seeds out there over the next couple of years, but they won't make any firm decisions about what to do with all that until years from now. They'll look back and go, okay, well, we can say that this was a, you know, it's kind of like they said, oh, the Cosmic Cube, that was Infinity Stone. There was never a plan that the Cosmic Cube was an Infinity
Stone. Yeah, I was going to say, because I remember, you know, when this all was going on, I said, I don't remember them actually saying anything about that being a, yeah, so.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So you can do that now, right? You could have, you know, Doctor Strange 2 involve some thingamabob, and then 2 years after that, you can go back and say, oh, that was actually this thing, you know, and start a whole new thing. But yeah, you need to let the audience calm down. I mean, we've just had almost $2 billion, or what, almost $3 billion, how much ever it's made now, thing. People need to just take a breath. We need a couple of years of very little continuity now. I feel like you exhaust the audience.
Yeah. Because obviously they're going to make a Black Panther 2. They're going to make a third Guardians of the Galaxy, which sounds like it's just going to be the closure of their own trilogy. Mm-hmm. And it's not going to, you know, that's just going to be it. How do you think the Eternals fits into all this?
I have mixed feelings about that because I feel like
they're going for big star power in that.
Yeah, but
I still
think it's in its own little world, though. In other words, I think it's going to be a big thing in and of itself, but I don't see it being like an Avengers movie. I think it'll be more like the first Guardians of the Galaxy movie, where they just throw out all these brand new characters all at once and kind of, you know, try to have a good chemistry there. That's my view. John, what do you have any feeling about the Eternals? I mean, because they're so obscure anyway.
I think it's a good parallel to Guardians, because I think a lot of even people who read comic books didn't know much about the Guardians, especially that Guardians group.
Right.
When they made that movie. So I think it's a good parallel, and I think it's they can go do some weird stuff, but they could tie it into the magic stuff they've been doing with Doctor Strange or some of the other things in the long run. And I think it's just another, you know, it's another card they could flip over and expand the universe in different directions with it and do different things down the road. But you're right. They don't have to tie it in any kind of larger thing anytime soon.
You know, they were,
how long do you think they wait until they bring X-Men in?
Ooh.
I think they'll tease mutants within a year. There'll be mutant references in a movie, or that guy's we're hearing stuff about mutants. It'll be in, you know, it'll be one of those things where it's on the paper in the background on a TV, or they hear something, or there's some end of movie cutscene where there's somebody's talking about mutants.
What do you think of this? This was a fan theory thing, and you know how fan theories go. But with the Infinity Gauntlet being used, you know, twice on Earth, and that potentially affecting things, that maybe that's a way for them in their own universe, even though it's not necessarily a comic base, you know, in the comics or whatever, that's a way to explain why mutants are starting to become a thing, because of some type of, you know, the gamma radiation, because the Hulk in the movie made sure to mention, talk about the gamma radiation from the gauntlet itself and all that.
Oh, yeah.
And the stones, and it was emitting. I wonder if that would be just like an easy way to just sneak in there. Like if they decide, hey, let's just start talking about X-Men like 2 years from now, you know, in movies, we just go, you know, that thing really changed the world. Not just that it, you know, it brought everybody back and we lost 5 years with a lot of people, but it also it started doing things that we didn't foresee. And that's these new mutants coming about. I don't know how I feel about that theory, but I say that to say this. A lot of people seem to think that they're just going to wait a while before they do like an X-Men movie. Hmm. Personally, I don't think they will. I think within the next 5 years, they're going to make an X-Men movie.
Oh, yeah. Next 5 years. I think that they haven't wanted to say a blessed word about it yet because they didn't want to crap on Dark Phoenix. And that wouldn't be cool if they did, right? I mean, because...
Well, Dark Phoenix already crapped on itself.
I was going to say, yeah. They didn't want to tie any of their stuff to Dark Phoenix's own crap. So.
But I mean, I think that Feige and those others have realized some very important marketing lessons the last few years. Like, it's the same thing with when they rolled out their big Phase 3 announcement, you know, a couple of years ago, and they named, like, every movie for the next 5 years... And I think what they realized in retrospect was that people were less interested in the smaller ones because they now knew what was coming bigger later. Or, I mean, it may have heightened some interest about them, but, you know, you always knew, well, why go see this when there's this? And it's the same thing there. People have been literally saying, why should I go see Dark Phoenix if the MCU is just going to reboot the X-Men in a couple of years anyway? So they got to be coy, right? They got to say, oh, no, this is the X-Men. Go see this. You know, we're not doing anything with them for a while. And then once Dark Phoenix is out on DVD or whatever, then I think the MCU will be free to be much more open about their plans. That's my theory anyway. And honestly, I've said all along, what I'm more excited about having Fox in Disney now and Marvel is that for the first time, the MCU has access to Kang and to the Fantastic Four and Doctor Doom and Galactus and the Silver Surfer.
I'm more excited about what they do with Fantastic Four than X-Men.
Yes, me too. Absolutely.
It's the first family of Marvel, and it's never been done right.
It's never been done right. And it's so easy. I just have never understood. And so, yeah, and you know what? Here's another, I think, important point. The X-Men have been, if anything, kind of overexposed the last few years. But the Fantastic Four are due for a comeback because they've almost been forgotten over the last 10 years.
Yep, so I agree with that.
If they roll out...
The best... I was going to say the best Fantastic Four movie is the one that wasn't released in 1994, was it?
Corman,
I think.
Roger Corman.
I actually kind of liked that one. It was not a good movie, but you could tell that people cared.
They cared,
and that they put some effort into it, and it was not afraid to be kind of cheesy. I liked it. It's better than any other Fantastic Four movies that have been released.
It's a low bar, but yeah, I've got the VHS somewhere here behind me on this bookshelf actually. But I picked up at DragonCon a few years ago. But yeah, it's the funny thing about that Roger Corman Fantastic Four movie. It has like a 5-second Human Torch on fire CGI from the mid-90s.
Oh, that's off.
That cost more than the whole rest of the movie put together.
Nice.
And it's awful. Yeah, it's awful.
It's terrible.
And it costs more than the whole rest of the movie. But yeah, no, I mean, they need people that care about the characters. And I think they'll certainly be in better hands in the MCU with Kevin Feige and company than they have been in any time before. So yeah, I desperately want a good... I mean, you bring in Doctor Doom, you bring in the Silver Surfer. I mean, there's so many great characters that are... I will never understand why Kang is considered a Fantastic Four character when he's the Avengers' like second biggest villain after Ultron. But anyway,
I felt that whole Ultron movie was a waste.
Yeah.
I thought they really screwed that up. In hindsight, but you know, you're talking about Kang and everything and Galactus. I read somewhere that this is a rumor that they think that they're going to continue Avengers movies, but they're just going to call them the New Avengers, and they're going to introduce, I can't remember who it was. But it was so underwhelming to me, the character names that they were bouncing around that are going to be introduced in the background of like the Black Panther 2 and some of these other movies that they've got coming down the pipeline. And then that by 2022 or 23, they're going to do a new Avengers movie. I just don't know if they should be doing a quote unquote Avengers movie, you know, within 3 or 4 years of Endgame. I think that's, why do we have to go the Avengers route? Why can't we go with Fantastic Four? Let's start that up and then bring it into another thing. Let Spider-Man grow up a little bit, and then 6 years down the road when he's in his mid-20s and is different, and then we got Miles Morales and all this other stuff. I mean, there's other things to do within Marvel that's not so everything structured around the Avengers. You know, I think they need to get away from that. But when I read that they're going to build up to the new Avengers movie in 2022 or 23, I was like, man, that's a little, to me that just seems so quick. But I guess, you know, growing up, I always think about this. Like when I was growing up as a kid, you know, when I was looking back between Batman and Batman Returns and all that stuff, it felt like forever. But today, you know, 3 years is nothing today to me. That's right. You know, as a grown up.
Yeah. No, absolutely. I think you need to wait 4 or 5 years. I think you do. But I think that at some point, the shareholders of Disney are going to say, "Hey, you got this $5 billion property. Why are we not doing more? You know, I mean, you push it as long as you can so people aren't sick of it." But at some point, you have to answer to the shareholders and say, okay, we're going to do something with the word Avengers in it. So I think there's a balance. It's hard for me to be anti-Avengers anything because I'm, you know, pretty much Mr. Avengers. I've run the website since 1995. Yes. But that being for 24 years, but that being said, no, I agree that you don't want to get people sick of it. And especially after something emotional like Endgame, you got to let it sit for a little while for sure.
Yes.
I know you guys have probably already talked about it, but I'm just interested. What were your thoughts on Endgame and that whole saga, so to speak, as we call it, the Infinity Saga now,
John,
coming to an end?
I mean, I thought Endgame was really well done in terms of providing closure for stories of the individual characters. And at the same time, they had kind of the fun time travel pieces where they went back to the different movies and did stuff. I didn't care about the time travel mechanics. I don't, you know, it's a comic book movie. I'm not going to get hung up about it. Right. And so I enjoyed it. I thought it was emotional. I thought it was like the closure of the individual stories was really powerful, I thought. And I thought it was well done. And at the same time, it had that epic moments of like what you want in kind of a super comic book movie where it has all these guys actually, you know, fighting it out in the way you want. So I mean, I really enjoyed it. I thought it was fun. And I liked Infinity War, too. I thought that was a good movie.
Yeah, the only thing, you know, seeing it in the theater, it's exhausting. I mean, it was emotionally just physically exhausting. I haven't gone to see it a second time yet. In fact, I kind of want to watch all of them over again and then watch it again. But the only negative I took from it, I didn't feel this way immediately, but the more I thought about it, the more I heard people talking about it, the more it kind of settled in on me, is I don't love what they did with Captain America at the end. It was one of those things where in the moment it's a feel-good thing, but if you put any thought at all into it, it just totally falls apart and threatens to ruin everything. And so I kind of wish they had exercised a little more restraint with regard to Steve Rogers at the end. But other than that, I think it's an absolutely towering achievement that you don't even try to match for a long time. What did you think about it?
I really liked it. You know, I'm not a Marvel guy, but that was the first Marvel movie where I had like just like primitive reactions, clapping out loud, yelling. I yelled at one point in the theater.
Probably weren't the only one.
I know I wasn't, but I was. But it was like I wasn't reacting to other people around me. It was just like my own reaction. Mm-hmm. And but part of me was also sitting there going, "Man, if this was a DC movie, oh my god, can I imagine what I'd be feeling right now?" But you know, but I loved it. I'm kind of with you there on the Captain America arc. And maybe it's just because I'm too dumb to understand, because they pretty much told you, don't worry about this time travel stuff in the movie. That's what they pretty much really told you. You know, they explained it well, and they had their own rules, and they did a good job of explaining those rules. But what happened with Captain America didn't make sense to me.
It didn't.
Like the timeline stuff, like how is he there? No. Was he always destined every timeline to always be with her?
The more you think about it, the more it falls apart. It just doesn't make sense.
I don't know. And because I say that to say this, because when they travel back in time in 74, whenever it was, and he sees her through the window, and there's a picture of him there. And all I could keep thinking while I was watching the movie was, how does she not see him through that pane of glass right now? How does she not see anybody and go, why is there someone in my office? Part of me thought that she knew he was there and that they were together even then in that timeline.
Right.
And so she saw him and thought, you know, he's told me about time travel and all this other stuff because it's happened again and then again and again or whatever. I don't know. But it just, that was like, I was okay with the time travel stuff until that thing happened with Captain America.
Yeah.
But still, I still liked his arc. I thought he actually had the best arc in the entire franchise.
Yes.
Because he's a man stuck in time and stuck in his ways, but for good reason. But then you start seeing the cynicism starting to get to him, but he never lets it affect his core. And I just love those little moments when the cynicism comes to him. Like, I went crazy. No one else did in the theater because it was a small moment and it was just part of a scene. But when he walks up in 2011 or whenever it was in Avengers Tower and he sees himself and he cusses, he just says the S word. I went nuts because I was all like, this guy finally is just, you know, Mr. Good Boy is just like, you know, he's not totally bad. He's just like, man, I'm not this guy anymore. And this, I know what this guy is going to do. I love that. And then of course, you know, all the other stuff. I loved it when he said, I could do this all day. He's like, yeah, I know. it's great stuff. But, the ending when he's sitting on the bench, I just didn't. I don't know. It was just weird. And I guess Bucky knew that was going to happen because he told him. Do you think that's what happened? Because before he went back in time, he told Bucky, listen, I'm not coming back. I love you, man. I think that's what happened, right?
Honestly, Brandon, I've written several books involving time travel. And the one thing I can say is it's tricky enough if you just stick to the basics, but when you start making it more complicated, it just it just goes crazy. It just unravels like a sweater. So,
I think he went back in time obviously just, he was not going to come back. And I think he told Bucky based off the way Bucky nodded at him before he left and everything. Yeah. And the way he stood away in the back as he talked to Sam. Yeah, to Sam, I just thought that he knew because he told him, listen, man, I'm going to go live my life and after I get this done, whatever. And so I know when people are complaining, like, why isn't Bucky given the shield? I think it's because he knew what he was going to do all along because he told it. I mean, he didn't know he was going to give a shield to him, but he just knew that, you know, this was the end of his story. He wasn't coming back to be a part of this team again, that he's done his job, he's done enough, it's time to have his own life. So I thought that was a subtle little great nod, but I don't think a lot of people picked up on it. Maybe I'm misreading it, but
as fair of a reading as anything. Absolutely.
The time travel stuff with him and how that happened doesn't make sense to me at all.
No. Again, I think they went for the, you know, the Saving Private Ryan little warm fuzzy ending, and they said, you know, yeah, it doesn't make sense, but just go with it, you know, and that's fine, and I'm just going to try to go with it. I'm not going to worry.
What would you have done with them? I'm interested. What would you have done?
I think a lot of it is knowing that Chris Evans isn't coming back. So they needed some kind of an ending for him where he's not, you know, I mean, most people thought he was just going to die, like Tony Stark. And he wasn't going to be around in the present as young Captain America and just never show up in future, you know, emergencies. So you had to do something with him. You either kill him or you make him not Captain America anymore and not able to be Captain America anymore. So aging him like this, I think, is as good as anything you could have done with him. And aging him after spending his life with his love is a really particularly nice way of removing him from the board, you know, since Chris Evans isn't going to be in any more movies. But it works technically, right? It works in that way. It just doesn't necessarily make logical internal sense within this story, but it serves a bigger purpose. So I mean, I hate to say I would have killed him, but I think that's your only other option, really. I don't know what else you could do.
Yeah. I probably would have killed him. And I would have, I don't know how I would have done it, but all I can think back to is him with his broken shield standing up, not giving up, even with an army coming at him. And then I thought that was fantastic with the on your left line and all that stuff. Yeah. But the dark part of me would have had Doctor Strange opening the portals and everything a little bit too late and Captain America getting killed just moments before they all arrived. And then that rally, it doesn't rally them because they were going to do what they were going to do, but
yeah.
It inspires him a little bit more. And then Tony sees that and sacrifices himself because he knows that. Okay, listen, they've been building up to Tony sacrificing himself since the first Avengers. We all know that. Right. Since he took the nuke into space. But, I don't know. I mean, listen, I'm acting like I could have done a better job with this. I couldn't have because it was darn near perfect what they've done over the last 10 years. It's incredible.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. All right. Well, I think we're about out of time. But, Brandon, as always, it's always so great to have you on, get talk about all this fun stuff, and we really, really, really appreciate it. Maybe we'll see you this fall if we get to do another video show.
Yeah, I had a lot of fun at that with that on campus. That'd be great. And I'd love to have you guys maybe come on my video show, too, later, because I'm starting one up
awesome.
This summer. So... we'll see how that goes.
Look forward to it.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, man. Well, I guess at this point, our time is up, and we thank you for yours. War Eagle, Brandon and John.
War Eagle, man.
Thanks for listening to the Wishbone Podcast. All past episodes are available at auwishbone.podbean.com and via iTunes. For more Auburn fun, join us on Facebook at facebook.com/auwishbone and follow the show on Twitter at auwishbone. War Eagle. Becomes of you, my love. When they have finally stripped you off, the handbags and the glad rags that your granddad had to sweat so you could buy.
This has been a White Rocket Entertainment production.
Thank you for listening to the AU Wishbone Podcast.
Go to bed.